A new report finds very different outcomes in Michigan's child welfare system depending on race. The Michigan Race Equity Coalition in Child Welfare and Juvenile Justice prepared the report. Paul Elam, Director of Safety and Justice for Public Policy Associates, was the report's project manager. Tell us what this report shows. Give us some of the highlights or perhaps maybe the concerning points of things that should get our attention about the child welfare system in Michigan.
Public Policy Associates has been working in partnership with the State Court Administrative Office, the Department of Human Services, and Casey Family Programs for the last 3 years, looking at disproportionate minority contact in our child welfare and juvenile justice system. The coalition was brought about based on a charge from Director Maura Corrigan to look at issues of fairness and equity for kids and families in the state of Michigan. And Public Policy Associates was the contractor and project manager for that work and established a statewide data set that the coalition could actually review to look at key decision points in our child welfare and juvenile justice systems to assess disproportionality. And over the course of that three-year period, we were able to assemble a four-year trend analysis report that looked at all 83 counties at these key decision points. And at a high level, what the report found is that youth of color, specifically African-American youth, were more likely to be investigated for abuse or neglect, were more likely to be removed from their homes based on investigations, and then were more likely to age out of the system upon removal from their home. And the coalition is really interested in making sure that decisions that are being made are not due to disparate treatment. And so there's a difference in disproportionate treatment and disparate treatment. We believe that disparate treatment is the result of decision makers making unfair decisions based on race and ethnicity. And that's not what our report points out. It really points out disproportionality, that there's an overrepresentation. And so the coalition is now in a position to determine if that disproportionality is due to disparate treatment or if it's explainable by some other factors or key conditions that exist within the communities that were highlighted in the report.
So when kids go through the foster care system and then they age out, what is the cost to them? What does that mean for them going forward? And what does it mean for a cost to society in a broader sense?
Well, I think the cost to the child, him or herself, and their family is not really launching kids and the positive trajectory that we would like them to. Unfortunately, we have many kids who grow up in impoverished conditions, in neighborhoods or family units where they aren't safe or they don't have access to the developmental needs that we think all kids should have to actually thrive and become adults who can contribute positively to society. And so I think the whole notion of having a child welfare system to help in those instances is great. But I think far too often when we look at the programs and policies that are in place, they tend to be underfunded. They tend not to be evaluated. When we do find things that are working, we tend not to do enough of it. We tend not to make those resources available in counties, cities, neighborhoods, communities that actually need those resources. And we've got to do a better job in trying to help these youth. And as I just stated, I think some of the short and long-term consequences end up in systems that they probably shouldn't be in. And so who grew up in those conditions, I don't think deserve to be in a juvenile justice system because they have a mental health issue, a poverty issue. And many times they're acting out, we know, due to growing up in those conditions, and therefore it becomes a delinquency problem. And if it persists over time, then it can become an adult corrections problem or a criminal justice problem. And so I think in summary, we have a large group of youth who become disconnected youth. They're not in school. They dropped out of school. They're not contributing productively to our economy. They're not employed. They're not seeking higher education and becoming a part of our higher learning system. And they become disconnected. They're not contributing, and therefore they become consumers, quote unquote, of our system's resources. And every kid that's a consumer versus a contributor, I think, helps create a system that we really don't envision. That's not what the child welfare system was developed for. And so we need to make sure that we're coming to the table with the appropriate leaders, elected officials, many of our philanthropic partners, developing public-private partnerships to help wrap our head around how we can produce better outcomes. I think for society in general, it really feeds off of what I just explained. I mean, we want society, not consumers from society. And many of the youth we talk to as we engage in focus groups, they will tell you, we want jobs. We want a place where we can contribute. And they can articulate some of the barriers and deficits that existed in their homes, in their communities. And they feel if we can help them overcome some of these barriers or deficits, that they would be positioned to be productive citizens. Many times we say we don't have the resources to provide these developmental needs that youth have. And it always strikes me that we don't have those resources, but if they engage in a delinquent or criminal act, we can find $30,000 to $100,000, depending on what system they're connected with, the juvenile justice or criminal justice system, on an annual basis for one of these individuals to be locked up, incarcerated over a 12-month period. So where was that $30,000 to $100,000 when we were advocating for community-based programs that we said we didn't have the resources for, but all of a sudden if they commit one offense, delinquent offense, we find $30,000 to $100,000 to incarcerate them. So I think it's not an issue of the lack of resources. I think it's an issue of political will and our ability to sit down and strategize and come together and find out what's best needed and suited for youth and families who grew up in these conditions.
Are there states which could serve as a role model for Michigan? This can't be a problem only in Michigan, so I'm wondering if you've looked at some other states and if you found systems out there that Michigan could try to emulate.
Yes. One of the reasons we're partnering with Casey Family Programs is because they are connected with pretty much every state looking at these issues of disproportionality in states' child welfare systems. They launched a national partnership with the Center for the Study of Social Policy a few years back, and Michigan was one of the sites that came in and partnered with them to do a institutional analysis. We did it in County and Saginaw County. And as we did that work here, Casey Family Programs was able to bring lessons learned from other states as we did that work. And I think what we're seeing in some cases is as we struggle with issues here in Michigan, they're able to point us to experiences, lessons learned from other states. Some of that work has come directly out of the state of Texas, for example, where as we thought about solutions and strategies here in Michigan or ways to develop coalitions or prior reports that looked at some of these same issues, they're bringing that learning into our collaborative or coalition that we've started here in Michigan to help us as we go through this work. And so there's been key moments in the three-year process where Casey Family Programs has been very instrumental in bringing those lessons to the table, not only in the form of recommendations or reports, but sending individuals to our meeting to help us think through these issues. And so the whole notion of looking at equity and looking at disproportionality, there are many ways to look at that. And so to have experts or jurisdictional partners who've done that work in other places is very helpful, so we don't run into the same mistakes or try to reinvent wheels that have already been built and are successful.
The CETA Scholars Program here at Western Michigan University has been recognized in many quarters for helping students after they age out of foster care to have success in college. And I'm wondering if you look at a program like that and see that perhaps there's some things in it that could also be gleaned to for other parts of foster care that could help students in other situations, maybe not just those going to college or a university.
Yeah, I think that's a great program. I haven't seen an evaluation of it myself. I've been exposed to it, talked to participants, you know, students who participated in that program. In fact, in some of our reentry work, we work with youth who have been released from juvenile justice systems and placed in the CETA program, and really see it as an opportunity to get back on a positive trajectory. I mentioned earlier that when kids age out, if they don't have a system to connect with, there's unfortunately a system waiting to pull them in, the juvenile justice system, our adult correction system, and the like. And so if we can create systems like the CETA Scholars Program that says we are waiting for youth who age out, I think that's the direction we want to move in, where we can help continue to provide supports and even expose youth to higher education opportunities to prepare them for a career path in a conventional manner. I think some of the things we're looking at as we make our recommendations as a coalition reflect that as well. And so we've made recommendations in three key areas, not only programming, but systems change. And I'll talk about that in a bit if you would like to do so, but also training. I think we call it a three-pronged approach. We need programs like the CETA Scholars Initiative, but we also need practitioners and caseworkers and managers and leaders of those systems to come to the table with a new frame of thought, and we call that systems change. We have to change how we do business day in and day out if we want to produce different outcomes for our youth and families who get connected with the child welfare system. If we do the same thing and expect a different outcome, then I think we're fooling ourselves. And then we need formal training to help sustain those systems changes, and we also need some shifts in policy. And so I would argue that we need great programs like the CETA program, but we also need to add to that some training and policy change and some systems change efforts to help sustain that over time so that we can shift some of the numbers that we're seeing in this report that we released.
Are you optimistic that that can be done, that the political will, I guess, is there to bring about the sort of systemic change you'd like to see in this system?
You know, based on what I've seen over the last 3 years, I am very optimistic at this point. We've done work, I know, in this state for at least the last 15 years on this issue. I was a part of a prior coalition and a part of a prior study where we did some work, not at the state level, but in targeted jurisdictions. And this time around, I think we really had great representation from at least two branches of the government. I think we could have done better with our legislative representation, and that's what this forum was about that we just had on Wednesday of this week, was to get our legislators involved by educating them and reaching out to them to let them know that we have an issue in our state. But I think why I'm optimistic, you have the Supreme Court leading this work. A key co-chair is Justice Mary Beth Kelly, and she's been engaged in this work across the last 3 years. We have our other co-chair, Lynn Jondahl, who's an ex-representative and really knowledgeable about what we need to do to try to move things through a legislative process. And then, as I mentioned, we had Director Maura Corrigan herself charge this committee to do the work, and is very interested in seeing that we do something to address the underlying causes. And then you also have a statewide representative group of child and family-serving agencies who sit on this coalition who have been very dedicated to this work. And we are now moving into a phase where we're going to move our key recommendations into plans of action. You know, folks might be thinking, we've heard that before, we've done that before, and we haven't seen movement. But I would argue that we're already beginning to see movement. We actually developed a demonstration site as we did this work in Saginaw County. And as we were doing our work at the state level, the Saginaw County leadership team was actually going through the same process. And there are already recommendations that are being implemented. And we're trying to learn from the Saginaw County experience how we might replicate that work across multiple jurisdictions within Michigan, so that when recommendations are made, we not only can say, here's what you ought to do, but here's how you do it. Here's how a jurisdiction like Saginaw actually came together and made it happen. And so very positive for those reasons. There's leadership. There's a public-private partnership in place. We're getting all three branches of government involved. We have a state leadership team and local leadership team, and we're looking to expand that work over the next set of years coming.
So what are the next steps?
At the state level, what we plan to do is continue our work. And so we shared some of our high-level key recommendations. We're now going to move into work groups where we begin to operationalize those recommendations. And so if they're training recommendations, how do we get this training embedded in the state's training system, and how do we roll it out into jurisdictions? And so that's where a demonstration and pilot site become very helpful to help us think about the nuances and logistics, and then think about taking things to scale. If there are policy recommendations, then there'll be groups who kind of lead that work and have conversations with key thought leaders. And then if there are programmatic recommendations, it's really thinking about the funding and targeting using GIS technology, where these programs are most needed. Where do we see the disproportionality? Where do we see it at its highest rate? How do we target that to hopefully mitigate it and reduce it over time? And really bringing the coalition members back together periodically, annually, biannually, to look at the data to see if we're actually achieving the reduction in disproportionality that we seek. And so the coalition will continue to meet. It will continue to do its work. And it's not easy work. I think the structure that will play that role will be established over the next couple of months. And that will be the next rollout that we ultimately share with the public. Now that you see these recommendations, here's how we're going to structure ourselves to do something about it.
Paul Elam, thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to getting back on the phone with you to tell you about how some of this work has rolled out over time.
Paul Elam is with Public Policy Associates. He is the project manager of a new report showing racial disparities in Michigan's child welfare system.